Hello, and welcome back to the Joint Venture Podcast, Inspiration Insights. Today we are bringing you an expanded news coverage segment because we've not given you news in a couple of weeks now, so there's lots to be caught up on. I have with me our senior reporter, Zachary Skidmore.
Hi, Oliver.
And making her debut on the podcast, we are pleased to welcome our reporter, Aishwarya Hirsturay.
Hi, Oliver. Thanks for having me.
In this edition, we are going to go over, as I mentioned, a lot of news, and also the three of us have just come away from Inspiration's 2023 Energy Storage Summit. We'll be bringing you some of the key discussion points from our favourite panels of the event. That will be coming up later. But first, Zach, can you bring us up to date on the news?
Sure, there's a lot of news to go through, Oliver. So let's start with funds. The first notable news story I'd like to highlight is from Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners, who announced they had reached final close on two of their new funds. The first being the CI Green Credit Fund 1, which closed at a value of 1 billion euros with an additional 200 million in co-investments to date. The fund secured commitments from investors across the Nordics, Europe and Asia Pacific, with the vehicle providing debt financing with subordinated risk characteristics for renewable energy projects across those jurisdictions. The fund will focus on both greenfield and brownfield projects in renewable energy infrastructure space. The second fund they closed was ABF 1, which reached final close at 750 million euros, so quite similar to the previous one. And they're focusing on investments which advance bioenergy infrastructure with a primary focus on the European continent. The fund has so far taken final investment decision on one project with exclusivity agreements in place for several industrial scale advanced bioenergy projects. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about the bioenergy industry, we actually had an interview with Torsten Hall, who is the CEO of Vorn Bioenergy. So he really goes into the sector and the potential growth indicators and what really needs to be done to ensure that it becomes a central part of the energy transition.
Thank you, Zach. Can you put this in context for us? Where does this fit into CIP's other funds?
So they've made significant progress in several of their funds over 2023 so far. I'd like to highlight a couple of notable examples. In August, CIP secured a close from two Danish pension funds who invested 750 million Danish kroner in CIP's Green Credit Fund 1. Unlike CIP's previous funds, the Green Credit Fund is a credit fund whose goal is to support renewable energy projects through loans for infrastructure projects. Prior to this, CIP hit first close on its fifth flagship Copenhagen Infrastructure Fund 5, which closed at 5.6 billion euros in capital commitments. This fund will focus on greenfield investments within large-scale renewable energy infrastructure. It has a global reach and intends to diversify investments across technologies such as contracted offshore wind, energy storage, onshore wind, and solar in low-risk OECD countries.
There's been more news from CIP, I think, though, this week, hasn't there?
Yeah, the Jeonnam 1 offshore wind project, which is a joint venture between SKENS and Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners through its fund Copenhagen Infrastructure 3, reached financial close. Jeonnam 1 is the first offshore wind project under construction in South Korea and is located. It has a capacity of 99 megawatts and is located off the coast of Sinan County, Jeonnam Province in the southwest of Korea. We're able to learn a few further details on the recent financial close. Sources confirming that it was financed through a combination of equity and debt, with notice to proceed issued to all contractors and works on both onshore and offshore elements commenced with a targeted commercial operation date by the end of 2024. The project has also secured a 20-year fixed price offtake agreement with Korea Hydro and Nuclear Power through Korea's first wind offtake auction. Sources have confirmed the agreement covers the full 99 megawatts of the project. So speaking further with CIP, they do have a large pipeline of offshore and onshore projects, but they have pinpointed South Korea as a core market for expansion because, as we all know, South Korea is still quite fledgling in the offshore wind industry. They're really building up their capacity. In the next 5 to 10 years, they're expected to have significantly more capacity in operation.
Yes, that's a really interesting deal, actually, because, I mean, it's not huge, 99 megawatts, but compared to some of the stalls that we've seen in European markets in the last year in the offshore wind space, particularly thinking about the UK and Germany here, seeing projects go ahead in less developed markets, it seems like there's fundamental realignment in how we have to think about the offshore space.
The East Asian market is primed for significant growth in the next 10 years because of their offshore wind potential. I think Japan, South Korea and the Strait of Taiwan all have projects currently under construction or in the planning stage. So we may be looking at the next real hotbed of offshore wind development. The next story I'd like to highlight comes from Finland, with developer Axpo acquiring development rights for a 25 megawatt onshore wind farm in Finland. The four turbine Lallax wind farm is located in the municipality of Vora and was put through the permit process by the previous developer Rosafors Invest AB. Construction on the ready to build project is expected to commence in spring 2024, with the project slated to reach commercial operations in 2026. The wind farm is a greenfield project, with Axpo yet to select a designated EPC contractor. Actually, in conversation with them, they did mention that this was probably due to seeking further financial commitments, both from international investors and internal domestic investors. So it will be interesting to keep an eye on this project to see how it progresses going into 2024.
It certainly would. And just the comparison there between those last two stories, the South Korean offshore wind farm expecting to enter commercial operation by the end of 2024 is incredibly quick compared to this project where they're only expecting that in 2026 on what is a smaller onshore build.
I think if you if our listeners were keeping an eye on kind of just the news regarding the industry recently, they've seen that there's been a lot of delays and issues, not only with the permitting process and the CFD process, as we saw in within the UK, but also turbine manufacturers have been suffering quite significantly recently. Was it Siemens who had a major malfunction at one of their wind farms, which led to a significant drop in share price? So it is interesting to see how the different regions progress with the offshore wind industry.
It certainly will be.
We also have an M&A story I'd like to highlight, which comes from I Square Capital, who acquired Absolute Energy in a 400 million euro acquisition, which relates to the development and construction of a 3 gigawatt pipeline of solar, wind and storage projects. The platform will also target adjacent technologies that address challenges of intermittent power generation, such as battery energy storage, grid stability and clean fuels. And the final story I'd really like to highlight is in the geothermal sector, something that we don't really cover so much on this podcast. But if you were paying attention to the latest allocation round of the UK government's Contracts for Difference, you may have noticed that the first geothermal projects were selected for CFDs. I was lucky enough to speak with the managing director of the company, Geothermal Engineering Limited, who together with investors from Kerrigan Capital and Fryer Renewables were awarded all three of the first Contracts for Difference for geothermal projects in AR5. We were able, as I mentioned previously, to speak to Ryan Law, who is the managing director of the company, about the project and the broader implications of the CFD on the UK geothermal market. And the main focus is on one particular project, which is called United Downs project. United Downs was one of three projects by GEL that secured a CFD in AR5, all at a strike price of £119 per megawatt hour. For Ryan Law, this was a significant landmark given the unique challenges geothermal projects face in securing a CFD. He stated to us that unlike a solar project, where you can provide a clear indication of capacity, geothermal projects are far more difficult, as you need to complete the drilling process to determine the level of baseload power the site will generate. They were able to do this with the United Downs project, but it was a very, very long process. As a result, GEL had to secure all financing before submitting the project to AR5 to provide an accurate estimate of potential power production. And success in AR5 was considered by Law as a watershed for the geothermal industry, stated that having a CFD underpins the revenue model and banks love it as they can see a fixed 15-year revenue cycle. This in turn is likely to make future projects much more attractive for investors, and as proof of concept for the technology, with success in the auction also underpinning the previous financial partnerships that the United Downs project had signed with Thrive Renewables and Kerrigan.
It's great to hear a bit more about the geothermal market, because you're right, we don't cover it that much. It's not really a new technology. Mm. It's not emerging, but the advancements in techniques from markets where it is highly established, like Iceland, for example, where a huge proportion of their power comes from geothermal sources, you're starting to see some of those advancements in technology start to make viable projects in places like the UK where they previously weren't. So, yeah, it would be really exciting if more of these potential sites were viable for geothermal projects in the future. And yes, we'll be keeping an eye very closely on any further developments.
Another interesting thing I'd like to highlight about geothermal projects in general, but United Downs in particular, is that baseload power is only its first stream of revenue, as the second potential revenue for this and also future projects is lithium production from the fluid produced during geothermal production. This may be a game changer, especially within Europe. There's pretty much non-existent lithium production, with much of the lithium coming from outside Europe. And this could really be a game changer for not only the geothermal industry, but also any industry which relies on lithium.
Thank you for that roundup, Zach. And also on this episode, we've got Aishwarya, who's going to give us some additional news stories. Aishwarya, what have you noticed in the news in the last couple of weeks that's really caught your eye?
First up, let's talk about a green ammonia and hydrogen project in Norway. Statkraft and Aker Horizons are teaming up to develop a green hydrogen and ammonia project in Narvik in Norway. The project has 600 megawatt capacity and it aims to produce around 1,500 tons of green ammonia per day. Having wrapped up the feasibility studies, the project is currently in the design process stage with FID expected in 2025. And commercial operations expected to begin in 2028. It's noteworthy that Statkraft and Aker Horizons intend to establish a jointly owned company called Narvik Green Ammonia with a potential 50-50 ownership split, which is expected within the next 2 years. Aker Horizons has already signed letters of intent for potential offtake agreements, and there has been a huge interest from German and Norwegian maritime industry. The project will rely significantly on public funding to cover their construction costs.
Really interesting that you've highlighted that story from Norway with the green ammonia production project. Hydrogen developments in Norway and the Nordic region in general are huge at the moment. And I think the maritime industry has really started to take off there in adopting alternative fuels such as hydrogen ammonia. And if you want to learn more about this, I'd keep your eye on your inbox on your Inspiratia subscriptions, because we'll be releasing a lot more information and a research report on hydrogen in the Nordic markets very soon.
The second one I've got is from Poland. So ONGE Zielona Energia, a subsidiary of ONGE, they've recently completed the purchase of two onshore wind farms in Poland, Kukinia and Tekowo. ONGE signed an agreement to acquire Eolus in July 2023. It was subject to approval from Poland's Office of Competition and Consumer Protection. Recently, which is 5th October, these wind farms received a green light, allowing the assets to change hands. And following this approval, the sale of Eolus, the SPV, which owns the wind farms, has now been finalised. These wind farms were previously owned by infrastructure investor Margreet's Margreet One Fund and RP Global. These wind farms have a combined power capacity of 103 megawatt with Tokovo and Kukinia, and both of them are in operation. With this acquisition, ONGE's total production capacity in Poland has reached 336 megawatt, including 241 megawatt in wind farms and 95 megawatt on solar projects. That's all from my side, Oliver.
Thank you very much for the roundup. Also this week, Zach, you had a sit-down interview with RES. Could you tell us what you discussed and what people can expect if they look up that story on the website?
Just to give a bit of background to RES, it's one of the world's foremost independent renewable companies. It's developing a pipeline of over 23 gigawatts of renewable energy assets globally. And it works across the sustainable infrastructure space, both as a developer, EPC, and service contractor. So basically across the entire space. We were able to speak to Marco Perona, who's the CEO of RES's EMEA operations. And we focused on a number of things. Firstly, they made a major acquisition a few months ago in August 2023 of Energyteam's renewable service division, which expanded RES's O&M services and asset management services, I think they're almost by double, up to 35 gigawatts. So we focused on that acquisition, but we also went into the offshore wind sector, digitalization's growing role in managing the renewable energy sector.
That story, among with all of our other Q&As, can be found for free, open access, on the Inspiratio website. You don't need to be a subscriber through those. We have all just come back from Inspiration's latest industry event, Energy Storage Summit 2023. Now, I had a great time at this event, and I feel like we got to experience quite a wide variety of the energy storage market. We got to talk to many of the market participants who are really pushing these deals and making it happen, and also talked very thoroughly about some of the concerns that they have with the market, with the investment case in energy storage right now, and focusing particularly on the UK, but also we talked about global developments. Guys, what did you think about the event?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was lucky enough to sit on the last panel of the day, which was dubbed Pushing Forward, Developers Within Energy Storage. The panelists covered a number of different topics, namely the biggest opportunities within the energy storage market. Europe is really leading the way in this, with the UK kind of like the market leader. But they also stated that business planning can really be expanded to any jurisdiction with similar renewable penetration. So it's not that much in the way of the battery energy storage market growing in other jurisdictions. It's just kind of the wherewithal and also the talent within that country in order to facilitate the growth of it. So they pinpointed areas such as the Nordics as the jurisdictions that are really going to see growth over the next 5 to 10 years. But they also discussed a lot about just the growth of the technology itself. Marek Kublik, who's the MD of Fluence, mentioned that we're actually at the seventh generation of energy storage technology, and lithium-ion especially has just seen continual improvement, with costs falling around 10 times and improvement of 5 times in density. So nowadays there's been a real inherent focus on larger scale and longer duration batteries. So the projects being announced within the sector are just growing exponentially. Before they're around 10 megawatt, 5 to 10 megawatts about 5 years ago, but now we're seeing 50 to 100 megawatt projects with upwards of 2 hour storage time.
That's really interesting. So there's obviously going to be a lot of optimism speaking to people on the developers panel, because you know they are making the case to investors that they want to see investment in their own projects and want to see the market doing well, of course. Did they get on to talking about some of the problems with the revenue models that they've been facing in the last period, or perhaps some of the issues that investors have with that sector?
Well, they mentioned that you can't de-risk the sector completely because the underlying macro base case is on profitability. So there's a mismatch between high returns and completely de-risking the industry. They also mentioned that there's also... Of course, I think it's going to be mentioned quite a lot, this conversation of grid connection and the fact that they're competing not only with other renewable technologies, but all other energy technologies, be it gas peaking or anything like that, and also data centers. It was mentioned that data centers could be a major competitor, but it was also pointed out that data centers really need to green their fleet and replace the diesel backup that they're currently using. So battery energy storage could be a major technology in displacing that.
Yeah, what you say about the issue of grid connections, I think was very true. Every panel, to some extent, touched on the issues that developers are facing in connecting to the grid right now. We did have a panel session on that, which I was able to sit in on. The grid facilitating the route to market was the pre-lunch panel. And, you know, there was a lot of optimism throughout the day, but I think this is where we really saw where the issues lie in getting developments onto the grid in the short term.
An interesting case that was made was that volatility in the market actually provides higher revenues for these companies. So it was mentioned a couple of times that one day can make a year or even a decade for these companies, with the biggest drivers in energy demand being instances such as Suez Canal, COVID, and war in Ukraine. So it's very interesting to see how these obvious, really significant political and social issues actually drive up revenues for these companies.
Yes, it was an interesting point. In a lot of the other discussions we have in the renewable sector, particularly when speaking to pure play solar or wind generators, for example, volatility is not something that they like dealing with, because obviously when the generation is high there, their prices fall and they want stability through that. However, if you're someone who's operating battery assets on the grid, you want to see big spikes between the highs and the lows on a day-to-day basis so you can really gather that upside.
Another interesting aspect, this came from a conversation that I had previous to the panel with Max Slade, who is the General Counsel of Harmony Energy, and he spoke about how ancillary services are becoming a major part of the contracts that battery energy storage companies sign, and they're becoming shorter and shorter in the sense that you sign a contract with the national grid sometimes a day ahead. So you're going to provide ancillary services almost immediately for the national grid rather than signing these really long-term agreements over 10, 15 years, which we've seen previously. So it's all about flexibility, I feel. And as these services improve and data and digitalization becomes central within their delivery, we're going to see a lot more flexibility within the grid driven by these battery energy storage systems.
And we are going to get on to talk a bit more about the grid facilitating these projects a bit later. But first, I want to talk about that problem of volatility and how a lot of renewable developers are teaming up with battery developers in co-location and hybridization projects. Aishwarya, you sat in on this panel. What did you think were the main takeaways?
Yes, Oliver. So the panel I attended was on co-location and hybridization in energy storage, which I found really interesting. The panel discussion featured experts from Powerfield, Queenbrook Infrastructure Partners and Gresham House. I have three main highlights for you. One of them is benefits and challenges of co-location. One common concern that emerged in the discussion was the challenge of achieving optimal performance for both the co-located projects. Having said this, when it comes to optimizing renewable energy assets with battery storage, the consensus seems to be that co-locating solar and battery assets can mitigate potential revenue loss due to battery discharge. Another point we discussed was the design structure of the co-located project. There is no one template for developers to follow when it comes to co-location, as we have for separate solar projects or wind projects. So every developer will have to approach it uniquely, which has its own upsides and downsides. So early conversations with developers are crucial to finding the right approach. The second key question that emerged was whether co-location will become the new default for developers, especially for existing projects. Well, retrofitting existing projects presents its own set of challenges, especially concerning space and infrastructure. But there was a lot of hope for co-location in the future for many developers, as it offers greater flexibility.
What about when it comes to regulations that help these projects along? Was there any discussion on that?
Yes. So when it comes to regulations in the co-location space, it's clear that there are still many uncharted territories. Currently, there are no specific co-location regulations in place. Many are leaning towards DC coupling for its potential cost savings and efficiency. However, precise metering remains a challenge, causing some developers to pause.
So, what was your overall impression coming away from the panel?
I came out of the panel with hope, Oliver. In the discussion, it was observed that co-location is seen as a way for banks to enter this new space, to enter the storage market gradually. And this is going to pave way for more regulations and subsidies. And this is what will make co-location even more appealing option to the new developers and banks. Those were the insights from me and Zach. What about you, Oliver? You attended the panel on grid. What was it about? Tell us more.
Thank you very much. So yes, I did attend the panel on grid facilitating the route to market. And It was really a fascinating discussion. I feel like all of the conversations of the day revolved around the problem of connections to the grid. In part, the whole discussion around co-location and hybridization is built around this assumption that connecting to the grid is hard, and so it works better when you are able to tie projects together to better use that grid connection. It was highlighted on the panel that globally, there need to be hundreds of billions worth of investment made every year in upgrading the grid by 2030 on a global scale. And this kind of ambition for retrofitting existing systems and upgrading them to fit modern needs hasn't really materialized. We've mainly focused in the panel discussion on the UK market, where there's been good news and bad news in the last couple of months on the grid. We saw, for example, the grid amnesty a couple of months ago, which allowed unviable projects to remove itself from the grid queue, freeing up space for those which are now available. And I think the panel did do a lot of complaining about National Grid, about regulatory level institutions for not listening to the market. But there was generally a sense that things are moving in the right direction. For example, it was cited that National Grid are now saying the right things about making sure that as soon as a project is ready, it can have a connection. That's the aim. But making the regulatory process to that end goal apparent is not as clear as the messaging around it, because we're still seeing projects who are applying now for grid connections being put at the end of over a decade of waiting. There was actually quite a nervous murmur in the room when the panelists were asked whether they thought there was any chance for new entrants to come onto the market right now with those kind of wait times. Essentially, they said no, the market's cooked. Either the grid is reformed and expanded, or there's no more room for new players, which is a scary thought.
Grid connection has essentially been the asset that not only battery energy storage companies are after, but any form of power producer or any technology that needs access to the grid needs. So I think in my panel they talked about it's a lot easier just to purchase or acquire a company rather than starting it off from the ground up, because it's securing that grid connection which is the most paramount in ensuring success for your company.
That's right. The panel were discussing recent acquisitions and saying how a grid connection can now easily be worth double what the actual unit asset of a battery energy storage system is worth. So that grid connection is really of paramount importance. There's a lot of uncertainty in the market, which was also discussed. I think that the market in the UK in particular got very excited by incredible profits in 2022, which have not yet been lived up to in 2023. We've talked a little bit about the reasons for this, how the frequency response market is becoming a bit oversaturated, and how investors are now looking at that less favourably. But the need for regulatory reforms was paramount in the discussion, and the importance of having a diverse set of revenue streams from the different ancillary services available, including frequency response, dynamic containment, day-ahead markets. If you do want to make the most of a battery energy storage system on the grid, you really need to make the most of your connection and of dealing with multiple complex market revenues, taking advantage of that volatility we were talking about earlier. It was also quite interesting that the different solutions that came up. For example, vehicle-to-grid charging came up as a potential solution to ease the congestion on the grid. This is something that seems more promising now than has done previously. For example, we had Mark Henderson, CIO of GridServe, on the panel, who confessed that he had initially been very sceptical about the whole vehicle-to-grid charging proposition, but recent constraints in the grid system and advancements in the technology were starting to change that view. It was also interesting the other solutions that were being suggested. Sean Martin, commercial director at Modo Energy, mentioned that there were many ways that you could encourage people who are currently sitting on unused grid connections to remove themselves from the system. Because at the moment, there's a problem of if you remove yourself from the system, you incur fines. Well, one of the suggestions that was included was taxing unused connections, for example, which would heavily encourage the freeing up of extra capacity. So there's really an appetite in the market, I think, to find innovative solutions to connect into the grid using new technology, new solutions. Long-term storage was also floated as a way of more effectively using these connections for the future. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Joint Venture Podcast. I'd like to once again thank our contributors. Thank you, Zach.
My pleasure, Oliver.
And thank you, Ashwarya.
Thanks for having me, Oliver.
We'll be back again with more news and analysis next week. But until then, thank you very much and goodbye.